Welcome, everyone. Thank you for being here. Are both sides ready, or all the parties, rather, ready to proceed? Thank you. All right, so on behalf of respondents, I have an understanding that the argument's going to be divided up between Mr. Clark on behalf of the Apex respondents for 15 minutes, correct?
Correct.
All right, and then Mr. Allison is hoping that you're going to leave him 2 minutes, yes?
My best.
And I think we also have Mr. Verhees here, Pro Hoc Vici, and Mr. Beal is present as Nevada counsel remotely. Correct?
That's correct, sir.
All right, thank you. You wish to reserve any time for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor, I would request 5 minutes.
Okay. As a reminder, we provide both sides with 17 minutes total argument. The first 2 minutes are uninterrupted so that you can introduce your case in any manner that you see fit without any questions from the court. The bell will ring, obviously, for you with your rebuttal time. What we'll do, rather than the normal 5 minutes on the respondent's time, we'll just ring the bell at 2 minutes, reminding you to give Mr. Allison his 2 minutes, if you would, please. And on behalf of appellants, you can proceed, sir.
May it please the court, I'm Leon Greenberg, and I am arguing today on behalf of the appellants. King Alfred the Great of England in the 9th century compiled a written legal code, the Dune Book, dunes being laws or judgments, that many scholars cite as the foundation of our common law. Among its precepts was its commandment, drawn from the Old Testament book of Leviticus, to apply the laws evenly to all, both the rich and the poor, the weak and the powerful. This equality of the law, this conferral of the same legal rights to all who come before our courts, is at the cornerstone of our common law system, a cornerstone that the district court failed to follow in this case. My clients came before the district court standing in the same shoes as any other plaintiff asserting rights under the common law as a third-party contract beneficiary. They alleged promises were made in written contracts to pay them wages at the prevailing wage rate set by Nevada's labor commissioner, and that those contracts were breached, both by their employer and the other defendants. Having not received those promised wages, as pledged by those written contracts, they sought the same equal common law remedy available to any other person whose contract rights were violated. Yet the district court dismissed my clients' common law claims without any explanation beyond insisting they were derivative of my clients' separate claims seeking to enforce the statutory obligations created by NRS Chapter 338. My clients' common law third-party contract beneficiary claims do not rest upon and are not derivative of any statutory right. They are wholly independent contract law claims supported by over two centuries of precedent governing the common law of contracts. Nor has Nevada's legislature acted to abolish my clients' common law right to enforce the contracts at issue for their benefit as third-party contract beneficiaries. As discussed at pages 18 to 21 of the reply brief, 12 of the 14 state appellate courts that have examined this precise issue have found employees may sue for unpaid prevailing wages under the common law as third-party contract beneficiaries. There are only two exceptions. One was in Massachusetts, where a state statute authorizing employee lawsuits with triple damage awards for prevailing wage violations was found by that state's highest court to have acted to supplant and abolish the pre-existing common law right.
Mr. Greenberg, can
yes.
I answer? Hi. Sorry. Sometimes it's hard to see where the sound is coming from in here. Which of the claims in your complaint are a common law claim that you're arguing about?
The common law claims, I believe, are in the fifth claim for relief in the complaint. It is the last claim. The statutory claims were pleaded first. The allegations are that as required by NRS 338.020, the contracts at issue that their employer entered into, either their employer entered into directly with the state of Nevada or their employer entered into with other contractors who entered into contracts with the state of Nevada, explicitly required payment of prevailing wages at the rate set and published publicly by the Nevada Labor Commissioner for each craft as part of those contracts, and those contract terms were violated. So the point I am raising to the court is very simply that my clients were intended beneficiaries of those contracts under any common law analysis, and in fact...
So,
yeah, yes.
So I just want to pin this down. The fifth claim for relief is the claim that's a common law claim that you're talking about now.
That is correct.
Claims 1 through 4 are not.
Those are statutory claims raised directly under 338.020, seeking enforcement of those statutory obligations directly, and 608.150, seeking to enforce claims against the superior contractors of my client's employer, which is a separate statutory claim. But I was addressing, Your Honor, simply the issue of the common law right of my clients as any other third-party contract beneficiary. And as I was explaining, the only other jurisdiction which has rejected recognition of a third-party beneficiary claim in this situation where a public contract guarantees or requires a promise of payment of prevailing wages was in Minnesota. And that was a decision over a dissent by multiple Supreme Court justices in that state. And the foundation of that decision was that they found that, as a matter of common law in Minnesota at least, government contracts do not create the same common law rights to third-party beneficiaries as do private contracts. That was the foundation of the court's ruling in the Minnesota case. But what I would point out is neither of these exceptions to this uniform approach to this area of the law in this country would apply in Nevada. Nevada has not, through its legislature, enacted some specific enhanced remedy, as in Massachusetts, to address violations of the prevailing wage law that could have supplanted my client's common law rights. There certainly is nothing in the legislature, in legislative history, or in any statute indicating that those common law rights have, in fact, been abolished by the legislature, which, of course, would have the power to do so, but would need to do so expressly. And Nevada itself...
What do you do, sir, with NRS 338.090, which delineates the penalties that the labor commissioner is entitled to seek where prevailing wage is not paid?
Your question is, do those provisions supplant my client's common law rights as third-party contract beneficiaries?
My question is, could you comment on 338.090 and the power it imbues the commissioner with, and how that aligns with your assertion that you're entitled to claim as a third-party beneficiary prevailing wages that are statutorily due under the construct of 338?
Well, the Labor Commissioner's power of enforcement is separate and given to the Labor Commissioner to assist in enforcing and achieving the state goal here. But I would point out that 338.020, which is the actual statute that requires the payment of prevailing wages, begins by stating every contract in Nevada shall contain a requirement, and then it goes on to pay workers on the public works subject to such contract to prevailing wages. So the state of Nevada has given the Labor Commissioner an enforcement role, yes, but that is not an enforcement role that would supplant the contract rights that my clients derive as third-party beneficiaries of these contracts. And as I was reaching to in, and this is discussed at page 17 of the reply brief, this court has in fact recognized that public contracts entered into by government entities in the state of Nevada do create third-party contract beneficiary rights. This was the precise issue in the Williams versus City of North Las Vegas case. And again, that's at page 17 of the reply. That law has subsequently been reviewed by this court and not questioned. So we have a situation, again, where every single jurisdiction in the United States has recognized third-party contract beneficiary rights in this situation with good reason, because clearly my clients were intended beneficiaries of these contracts. They were the ones who were supposed to receive the promised prevailing wages. The statute at issue 338.020 doesn't say that employees shall be entitled to prevailing wages. It says the contracts that are entered into shall require this. If the legislature had intended to not attach to those contracts the same common law contract rights that exist in every other contract situation that have been recognized for centuries by this court and other courts, the legislature would have so stated. It did not. The district court conducted no analysis whatsoever of whether the common law right here had, in fact, been abolished by Nevada's legislature.
So, clearly, Mr. Greenberg, yes. I thought I heard you say a few minutes ago that the only jurisdiction rejecting the third-party beneficiary theory was a Minnesota case, but what about the Second Circuit case of Grakowski and then the Astra case from SCOTUS?
Yes, well, Your Honor, there is an important understanding to be gained from both of those cases. The Grakowski decision, and this is discussed in the reply, has in fact been described by the Seventh Circuit subsequently to exist in a jurisdictional no man's land, because the state of New York, which is where the Second Circuit was sitting and was the contract that that court was dealing with, has in fact recognized a prevailing wage third party beneficiary claim that arises from the exact same circumstances, a Davis-Bacon Act contract that the Second Circuit refused to give enforcement to in the Second Circuit. So actually in New York now, that is the Cox case, and this is discussed in the briefs. In New York, you have a situation where New York State, as a matter of common law, will allow claims as third-party contract beneficiaries under federal Davis-Bacon wage contracts, which are the federal analog of Nevada's prevailing wage contracts. But the Second Circuit will not, in fact, allow enforcement of those contracts. And this is actually discussed, again, in the reply brief. There's been criticism in the district courts in the Second Circuit of this very strange situation, but they're bound by Grakowski, and that is the law. In respect to the decision in Astra, what I would point out is that the Supreme Court of the United States, and this again is discussed in the briefs, has in fact recognized that government contracts can give rise to third-party beneficiary claims as a matter of contract. So that this was in the prior case of, let me see here, it was in the Murray v. DeKalb case, and this is discussed at the reply at page 22. In that case, there was a federal contract involving a municipality and a private contractor, and it was a question of whether federal common law allowed a claim to be made as a third-party beneficiary of that contract. The U.S. Supreme Court said, yes, you can. But subsequently in Astra, as Your Honor was pointing out, they did not allow those claims. And why did they not? Because there was a clear evidence. It was under the circumstances in Astra, we're dealing with a drug pricing scheme where the alleged third-party beneficiaries, which were these 340B entities, didn't actually know what they were supposed to be charged for the drugs at issue. They claimed the contracts at issue were not being honored because they weren't getting the prices they were promised, but the prices were actually secret because that 340B program was part of a larger Medicaid rebate program, which also involved rebates to the states involving Medicaid drug prices, so that the relationship of one, the pricing of those drugs, and the rebates that were given to the Medicaid programs in the states were actually related. And so therefore, to allow suits on those contracts would have clearly entangled the courts in the statutory scheme. It was clear, and in that case, the United States government appeared as an amicus and explained that allowing suits on these contracts in that situation would, in fact, interfere with their administration of the Medicaid program. So it was a very, very different situation. Here, there's no claim by anyone that enforcing these contracts and allowing my clients their rights as common law third-party contract beneficiaries to enforce those contracts would interfere with any state purpose. The state purpose here is to see that the workers on these prevailing wage projects are paid the wages that are set by the Labor Commissioner. The Labor Commissioner sets those wage rates. We're not disputing those wage rates.
Are there any of the statutory claims which under Chapter 680, which I think are claims 2, 3, and 4, that encompass something more than prevailing wage? So like overtime unrelated to prevailing wage or payment at termination unrelated to prevailing wage? Because it was a little hard to tell, for at least for me to tell from the complaint.
Well, what we have argued to the court and to the district court is that 608.135 as well as 608.150, the former was effective as of July 1st, 2021, gave an express cause of action to employees, former employees, excuse me, who are owed unpaid wages and are owed statutory penalties, and prohibits the Labor Commissioner from taking jurisdiction over those claims while they are pending before the courts of Nevada. So to the our position is that the language of 608.135 and the statutes it enforces simply refers to wages that are owed and compensation that are owed.
I understand that that's what you're saying. I just, as a factual matter, are you making allegations in the complaint that there's money owed to your clients other than money that's attached to the asserted failure to pay a prevailing wage?
Ultimately, the responsibility to pay the wages to my clients arise under two sections. They arise under 608.02 or 608.030, where those prevailing wage rates are set by the Labor Commissioner, and as a matter of contract. The question presented to the court is that statutory right enforceable? If it is enforceable, under what basis? Our position is that it's enforceable consistent with this court's ruling in Neville, which found that all wages that are owed to employees are, in fact, subject to a private cause of action in this court, because it would be absurd to assume Nevada's legislature intended otherwise when we have 608.140, which specifically authorizes the potential collection of attorney's fees in lawsuits for unpaid wages. And if we look at 608.140, 608.140 doesn't refer to overtime wages, which, for example, are owed under 608.018, or any particular provisions of 608 at all. The district court made this distinction between the obligations under Chapter 608 and Chapter 338. But when we look at what this court decided in Neville, and what 608.140 states, and what 608.135 states, which became effective in 2021, it does not distinguish between wages owed under Chapter 338, prevailing wages, and any other wages. They all deal with the collection of wages or claims, private cause of action, such as discussed in Neville, for unpaid wages. So there's no basis to make that distinction. And certainly the legislature gave no indication it wished to have that distinction made. My remaining time is for rebuttal.
That's used all the time.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. All right, on behalf of the Apex respondents.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chief Justice, Justices, may it please the court, Andrew Clark on behalf of the Apex entities and arguing on behalf of all of the respondents. I'd like to switch things up just a little bit to, from the start, address some of the arguments we heard and, more importantly, some of the arguments we didn't hear from appellant. As it pertains to the third-party beneficiary claim, I want to save that because I think what the court really needs to decide first is whether there is a private right of action for prevailing wages under NRS 338. Neither Neville nor the underlying authority, whether it's in NRS 608 or NRS 338, support either an express or an implied right of action there. And so the court may affirm the district court's decision on the first four causes of action under that basis. Frankly, Neville doesn't apply here at all. Neville dealt with a very particular set of claims under NRS 608 that differed dramatically from the public works projects envisioned in NRS 338. Stretching Neville to apply to private rights of action under NRS 338 would stretch it far past its breaking point and beyond what this court had ever intended. Second, The Labor Commissioner is uniquely situated to handle prevailing wage claims. From the very beginning, the Labor Commissioner sets the prevailing wage rate, is involved in determining which classes of employees are entitled to that rate, which counties get which rate, and is uniquely qualified and, under the legislature's apparent intent from the text, uniquely situated to govern and enforce that statute. And so if neither Neville nor the underlying statutes allow for a private right of action, it leaves this court right back where it was pre-Neville with Baldonado versus Wynn Resorts, and to determine whether or not the legislature actually intended to create a private right of action. I submit that the legislature did not, based on the fundamental difference between those statutes and the Labor Commissioner's intimate involvement in that public works process. The district court, therefore, was correct to dismiss each of plaintiff appellant's claims with prejudice, and this court should affirm. Now, the starting point is that there is no express private right of action within NRS 338. I think appellants would agree with us on that point, that nowhere in 338, aside from a particular set of causes of action for aggrieved bidders, did the legislature allow a cause of action. That tells us two important things about what the legislature believed 338 would do and how it would function. First, it demonstrates that the legislature knew exactly how to create a private right of action in these public works type claims. It did so with bidders, but importantly, and this is the second point, it also refers bidders to the Labor Commissioner first. And so we have a legislative intent not just to create a private right of action, but to continue to involve the Labor Commissioner. For that reason, appellants have to turn to this court's decision in Neville to try and stretch a cause of action from excerpted portions of this court's decision there. But the key to the Neville analysis was the statutory hook, NRS 608.140, that my colleague referenced, an attorney's fees provision that predates the prevailing wage statutes and that the court used to infer an action based on that attorney's fees provision. I think Neville states it best by saying the plaintiffs there tied their cause of action to a statutory provision that had an implied right of action. But in 338, there is no such provision. Where the legislature did create a private right of action, it was limited either to public entities or to bidders. Where there's attorney's fees provisions, they're limited to bidders or public entities or the Labor Commissioner itself. No other provision in 338 allows the same analysis that the court did in Neville. It simply would be inconsistent. And that makes sense. NRS 608 wages differ fundamentally from 338 wages. 338 is a public works project statute. The Labor Commissioner is intimately involved from start to finish. And it's not as simple as the appellants try to make it here, that the only issue here is whether or not someone was paid the correct rate. The Labor Commissioner, having been intimately involved in the process, likely already determined whether a certain class of employees, here plaintiff appellants, were eligible for prevailing wages and why. If the Labor Commissioner determined that they were not eligible for prevailing wages, it surely has a reason. The risk in implying a private right of action in 338 is that we almost invite inconsistent decisions between a Labor Commissioner who had a basis for excluding a certain type of either employee, job, county, rate, whatever the case may be, and a district court judge who was not involved in that process from the start. A second issue arises when, if the Labor Commissioner does determine that the employee was errantly omitted or erroneously omitted from the contract, there may be a future public works contract issue or breach for the Labor Commissioner to then be intimately involved in correcting. And so the terms of Neville combined with the terms of the statute simply do not support a private right of action that can exclude the Labor Commissioner. And at that point, and I'll kind of just switch bases just for a second because I think it matters for the third-party beneficiary claim that Mr. Greenberg spent time discussing. What the legislature has tried to do in involving the Labor Commissioner so heavily in the public works sphere is avoid an end-around, avoid the opportunity for the Labor Commissioner, who's so involved from the start, to be short-circuited either by a private right of action or a third-party beneficiary claim. And so Mr. Greenberg mentioned a handful of states. I think he said every state but two, which is 14 total of the 50. So it is certainly not a unanimous sample of all 50 states, but have found that certain states under their own prevailing wage statutes, which were not, which in the briefing is not clear whether they were similar or different. We don't know that. We contrast that with the rationale in ASTRA, which is the United States Supreme Court, and Grochowski, the Second Circuit, where both courts had the rationale of not allowing a private right of action to to short circuit what the lack of a statutory right of action. Let me say that slightly differently. Both ASTRA and Grochowski, and the federal courts to have cited it, have found that you cannot short circuit or Trojan horse a statutory claim based solely on a third party beneficiary theory. And that makes sense, especially considering the language of our prevailing wage statute in 338. one separate point, because we haven't had a chance to brief this issue, having just first seen it in the reply brief, appellants cite to Lane versus First Financial for the idea that the statute, 338, cannot abrogate the common law third-party beneficiary claim. What the appellants fail to cite is this court's subsequent opinion in December 16th, 2022, matter of Paul Sunderland Irrevocable Trust, that's 521 P3rd 1175 at note 5, the court recognized that abrogation of a common law right of action can happen either expressly or impliedly. Which sounds familiar. That's the exact issue we're dealing with here, whether there is an express or implied right of action. But I would submit that the clear legislative intent to reserve enforcement of 338 to the Labor Commissioner is at least an implicit abrogation of the right to third-party contract status here. And so whether the court affirms the third-party beneficiary claim as derivative, which it is, or on the basis that it has been abrogated by 338, which I believe it also is, the court may affirm for either of those bases.
Mr. Clark, how do you address Mr. Greenberg's argument that under Chapter 608, there's now an explicit right to make a claim for any amounts owed at the termination of employment, any wages, any compensation, and that's what his clients are seeking, so why can't they pursue accordingly?
It seems a simple argument, right? It is wages are wages are wages, it seems. But we've been cautioned not to review statutes in that way. I think this court's decision in Meyer versus Reno Cab Company is instructive. There, the court reversed a district court holding, applying the independent contractor definition from one set of the NRS to a different set of the NRS. And what was clear from Myers is that we don't look at statutory terms in a vacuum. They must be reviewed in the context of their particular statute. And so to respond to Mr. Greenberg's point that wages are wages are wages, I think that is a short-sighted view that overlooks this court's decision in Neville and the timeline of NRS 608.140. I'll just remind the court, just because it's pertinent, 608.140, upon which this court relied to imply a private right of action in Neville, predated the prevailing wage statute. So the idea that that the legislature intended there to be an attorney's fees provision for any wages simply is a historical impossibility, because it was enacted several years before the prevailing wage statutes were.
But I think their point is that you have a contractual relationship that I work and you pay, and this statute obligates, both 608 and 338 impose certain obligations on the employer-employee relationship, including like prompt payment when the employee is terminated, et cetera. But the employee has a contractual relationship in that exchange, and so they want to read as a term of the contract the 338 obligation of time and a half, of time and a half measured by the prevailing wage. And what's wrong with that argument?
Well, one, because 608 expressly exempts the prevailing wage statutes from the overtime statute. So NRS 608.018 exempts prevailing wages from its application. I think that demonstrates that the legislature intended these two statutes to be separate. So I don't think that we can just transplant any provision of 608, whether that's 020 through 050, which I think would be consistent with this court's decision in Martel versus H.T.
Staffing. I think their argument is you're transplanting 338 into 608, that as an implied contract term, the employee has the right to prevailing wage.
Unless, and we don't contend that an employee who is subject to a prevailing wage contract has a right to a prevailing wage. Where we differ is where that remedy lies, and that the legislature, in finding that the labor commissioner was the exclusive enforcer of the statute, abrogated that third
part of the contract. So then you really do have to ride the abrogation horse rather than implied remedy.
Well, just because the implied remedy is not the remedy that they would prefer does not make it inadequate. I think that.
Right. Okay, thank you.
So where does that leave us? Like if the provisions of Neville don't apply and the terms of 338 and 608 do not imply a private right of action or at least an express right of action, we're back to Baldonado. And whether or not the legislature intended there to be a private right of action within 338. We don't have a lot of legislative history on Section 338, but the legislative history that we do have and that this court has recognized, albeit in an unpublished disposition, which is Southern Nevada Labor Management Cooperation Committee, is that there is no statutory recognized private right of action in 338. There is not in 338. And so to the contrary of an implied right of action, we actually have a legislative history suggesting that there was a denial of a private right of action. It simply does not exist. And not to mention that implying a private right of action here would be inconsistent with the statute's overall purpose, which we see from the statutes that Justice Pickering mentioned in 338.090, 338.040. There is a very specific role that the labor commissioner has in public works projects that it does not have in NRS 608. And so to transplant Neville or any other provision within Chapter 608 would be inconsistent.
And what aspects of the prevailing wage statutory scheme support that it needs to be uniquely and solely enforced by the labor commissioner?
So that's the language in 338.040. I believe that the labor commissioner shall enforce the provisions of 338.020.
I get that. But what about the prevailing wage structure justifies that statutory treatment
as
a matter of policy?
As a matter of policy, it is far more efficient, less labyrinthian than the court system. The labor commissioner, through their website, has very detailed instructions on submitting a labor claim. There are forms in English and in Spanish. It is not a complaint process like in the court. There's not a huge filing fee. The labor commissioner really has her arms around this. And where we risk this kind of inconsistency with the policy and the intent of 338 is that given that the labor commissioner has her arms around this process from start to finish, it actually ends up being a far more efficient process wherein the labor commissioner herself can determine classes of employees, just like we have here, that may have been improperly paid or underpaid. And with that, I want to leave Mr. Allison some time, and so I would ask that the court affirm.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Justices of the Supreme Court, Chief Justice Herndon. I am the Lorax. I speak for the trees. Actually, I speak for the original contractors, but just the same, we do not want to be overlooked. The original contractors ask for one paragraph from this court to confirm that a party trying to assign derivative liability to an original contractor must allege in its complaint that the primary company was acting as a licensed contractor. This is to stop future overreaches of NRS 608-150. My clients did not employ or pay the appellants. They only hired the appellant's employers, the APEX respondents, onto public projects. At common law, they're not responsible for the payment of appellant's wages. Thank you, King Alfred. But we have 108-608-150, and it's a statute that's been misapplied for the proposition that original contractors are responsible for the wages of employees of every company they hire on a public works job. That's just not, that is just false. You read the statute, it's false. It only applies to subcontractors, not material suppliers, not equipment renters, not the porta potty people, not the street sweepers. Every case you'll find, if you look at 608-150 cases, involves licensed subcontractors. So the fundamental question for 608-150 is to ask, what did the original contractors hire the Apex respondents to do on these projects? And the answer is they were hired to deliver and remove fill, truck it in, truck it out, and drive around a street sweeper. No license is required for that activity. It is not contracting activity. I guess that's the end of my argument.
This goes quick, right?
It goes very quick. All right, thank you.
All right. Mr. Greenberg, you used all your time.
I did, okay.
During your original argument.
Thank you.